stop bouncing along their road, whichever any one of those digital meters, and I take the one 260 and then the meter hardly moves or whatever it is, I can go on. How did you make the reading so quick with that thing? How come? They have no training. There you are, just as Rich just said. They have no training in, we're dinosaurs, okay? There, that ends. You get laughed, you know, you get sometimes almost insulted with the comments that you get. But I've proven them wrong so many times in things I've tested and all told them what's bad and everything. I was being determined that way. I says, how many times I told them about power transformers that weren't right because I could tell how the saturation of the transformer acts on a 260. I want to see you do that with a digital meter. All right, we can go on with this indefinitely. Shall we go on with the mailbag, Dick? Over.
I got a quick question.
We're going to get to your quick question in a second. Oh, you hit a beautiful one there. And that is, you take a triplet or Simpson digital voltmeter, volt-ohm-milliammeter, or a vacuum tube voltmeter, but a volt-ohm-milliammeter, you put it on the 1-ohm scale. It's connected to the primary winding of a good transformer. And the instant you connect, the needle doesn't move. And all of a sudden, you watch the needle slowly crawl from infinity down toward, let's say, 30 ohms. If your primary has got 30 ohms of resistance, you watch it slowly coil as the magnetic field is built up into the primary winding of that transformer. And look out when you disconnect it. You'll get an inductive kickback and you get a little bit of a spark. And if your finger was holding that wire against the probe of the VOM, you'll get a jump. But that's the way a real transformer works. Now, you get a transformer with an open winding. Of course, it never moves. If it's the primary, it's open. But the most prevalent failure of a transformer is one turn short somewhere in the primary or secondary. The one turn short creates a huge decrease in the amount of inductance of the winding. If your winding maybe had 1 Henry of inductance when it's working normally, and if one turn becomes shorted, it becomes a millihenry instead of a henry. Instead of that normal slow crawl you get in the 1 times 1 scale, it'll jump immediately to the 30 ohm position, and you'll know. And when you disconnect it, you don't get the kickback. I'm going to pass it back to Mel first for a confirmation on this, then you pass it over to Rich. I bet you that's what you were doing, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Gotcha. Exactly. This is K2KEY. Exactly. In fact, how I explained it simply to people in the shop, I said, you see this old soldering gun, this old Weller soldering gun, the 250-watt iron? I said, how does it work? I said, you know something? I don't think half of them knew the heating element. I said, no heating element. It works by, it's got a coil, a primary coil. That's across the 110 volts. And what is heating, I said, is one turn in that coil. And that one turn is producing approximately 1.5 volts at about 50 amperes that's making that tip hot. Now, how do I know it's 1.5 volts? I says, you measured it. I said, no. I look at the light bulb lighting up, a 1.5 volt that light that comes on so you can see what the heck you're doing. And not to be used as a flashlight, but it comes on. And see that 1.5 volt bulb? That is a cross. Right across. That's the tip. And that, or that rod that supports the tip. That's a one turn. And I said, there's how it is. And they look at me like, they guessed it every which way, that and all. Most everyone says, oh, there's a heating element, the idea of it. Conduct to heat up those two rods. Dick, you want to hear some of this stuff. I says, not for me no more, Dick. I should have stopped when we stopped using that 250-watt iron. I should have called it quits, Dick, and when it's... I don't know. My grandfather always told me a delicatessen business is a good business, so maybe I should have listened to Dick. Over.
Yeah, that's I think it was IWC, very low audio. You could have proven to him that's not the heat spreading up from the gun to the tip, because you could have put your fingers on that big fat lead coming out of the Weller soldering gun. Now, IWC, please stand by. Rich already has a backed up question or comment. N2EL, go ahead.
Okay, Dick. This is
Rich
from
7 inch,
picture tube. So, with the yoke. So I took one, I got a 7-inch tube, and I told him, I said, Jaime, do me a favor. He says, what do you want me to do with this thing? I says, I want you to put in a P7 phosphorus. He says, where am I going to get this from? Where are you going to get P7 phosphorus? He says, it's not available. He says, that was World War II. They had them. I don't have it for that. So I took a bunch of the pig tubes. I got a number of them, the 5-inch ones. I broke them apart. We washed out the phosphorus from those tubes. I put it into the flask and refined it. We used to have a heat to cook it. And then poured it in for me into the 10-inch tube, which was a regular 10-inch, 50-degree yoke type picture tube. And made me put a new gun and everything on it, put it back together for me, and made me a 7-inch P7 electromagnetic type of CRT. Now, it was Rich, what you can do, there are still plenty of surplus tubes. If you want to put like a 4-inch, there was a number of 4-inch rectangular surplus tubes, but they have green phosphorus. They have a green trace. You can put a filter on it and blew it up a little bit, but there's plenty around. The only thing you'll have to do, Rich, is rewire the base. That's all. But I think Surplus of Nebraska still has those CRTs. A lot of them, those. There were 4-inch rectangular CRTs that were really at the end, towards the end of the production. But they have a P1 phosphor in them, Rich. A green, I think it's...
I'm not sure which one was green. However, there is a email going around that I'm looking for right now that both of you guys will get a lot of kick out of. The email tells you to go to this particular website and you watch a man in Germany build a vacuum tube. He literally starts out with his Swiss Army knife in the little bitty miniature scissors, and he takes a piece of sheet metal, and he cuts it up and very skillfully bends it, and you soon realize he's building the plate circuit, the cylindrical plate circuit. You watch him build the cathode circuit. You watch him do the glass blowing. You watch him install it. You watch him do the vacuuming and whatever. There is this YouTube video that lasts about 5 minutes, and you watch a man build a vacuum tube, tetrode, or triode. I know you don't want to do your own glass blowing, but boy, is that a fascinating thing to watch. And this is a modern-day guy. I can tell that this is done in the last couple of years. I wonder if either of you have seen that particular YouTube video.
I have. Well, I'll do it. I checked everywhere on the internet. I even checked places that specialize in hard to get tubes. For some reason, it's totally unavailable. It's still good, it just hasn't worked. It's just where the horizontal trace was. It's about the same size, now you know, as a 3RV1, but it's metric. So it might not fit in there quite right. I guess it's a war thought. I know there are people in this country that will rebuild an antique tube, like you said, Dick, an RCA 630 or something like that, or a Dumont system. But they don't handle modern instrumentation, CRT. I don't know if they don't have a gun, they don't have a sponsor, or they don't have the expertise, but I have not been able to find anybody who can cut the neck, refire, and put a new gun on. Think back to you.
Yeah, I've got a suggestion for you. You're going to love it. But before we get there, there was a person who wanted to sign in, and I got to get to him. That person who wanted to sign in, please try again right now, sir. K2LIW, my name is Dick. KC2QIW. Your audio could be a little bit louder. Go right ahead, Joe.
Actually, I have a quick question about a power on a computer.
Go right ahead. By the way, I'm not a computer expert, but maybe there's one listening, so go right ahead with your question, Joe.
Okay, it won't turn on. It won't fire up. Any suggestions? I'm thinking it could be the power supply, it could be the plug, or it could be a virus. It just died a couple of weeks ago. The power won't turn on, and that's my question. I don't know why it's not turning on. Back to the net.
Power supply.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. Whenever you get lack of response, if you like, I've learned the hard way. When you open up the case of anything and you start troubleshooting, before you get very far into the troubleshooting, make sure that every single voltage that's supposed to be there out of the power supply is there. Modern day equipment like a tower computer probably has a whole lot of current of plus 5, a medium amount of current of plus 12, plus 15, minus 15, maybe plus 6 regulator reference, and so on. And usually the power supply printed circuit board will have those voltage numbers printed on the pins that are supposed to produce those voltages. So before you get too far downrange, take out your voltmeter and measure every one of those voltages first. Because boy, have I chased my tail for days on end looking for a problem that had nothing to do with the circuits I was testing. All the gain was low in a particular receiver. All the gains in every stage was low. The S meter wasn't working correctly. The audio output was low, and so on. And it was because the reference 6-volt supply that controlled everything else was down to like plus 3 or plus 4 volts instead of plus 6. And I checked that earlier. I would have saved myself 4 days. So do look for power supply first. Of course, you're going to check the plug and the on-off switch and the fuse and all this kind of jazz. But after that, the very first thing I think is all the voltages. The most pleasant repair I've had recently is that I was doing some pretty exotic RF testing. I'm about to pass this over to Mel for his suggestions. But before I do, as I said, I was doing some fairly exotic RF testing. I borrowed a buddy of mine who owns I borrowed his spectrum analyzer, beautiful Hewlett Packard 85, 63, 65, something like that was the model number. Very good spectrum analyzer. Brought it over to my location, started using it, worked like a charm for 1 hour, and the screen went dark, and I heard a click. I said, oh boy, I'm in trouble now. I said, what the heck? Took off the bottom cover, and I looked at the bottom board that was easily accessible on the Hewlett Packard spectrum analyzer, and it was a power supply board that I was looking at and had about 7 or 8 different voltages. Each one of the voltages not only was labeled with a test pin, but alongside of each voltage was a light-emitting diode telling you that that voltage is present. And one of the voltages, the plus 12 volts, the light-emitting diode was lit. I connected my scope probe there. Instead of there being plus 12 volts, there was something like plus 2/10 of a volt.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
This machine has built-in troubleshooting. My goodness. That was Hewlett Packard's design, I'm going to make a guess, 1985 vintage. Boy, did they do human engineering in those days. Did they do maintainability. All of the power supplies were labeled. A light-emitting diode alongside of each one. The light-emitting diode not lit told me that that voltage wasn't present. I soon discovered that a tantalum capacitor had become a short circuit, and you would think the tantalum capacitor becoming a short circuit would kill that power supply. They anticipated the fact that the tantalum might become a short circuit, and it was a great big series power resistor going to the tantalum capacitor. And the power resistor was running hot, but it didn't burn up. All I had to do was replace the tantalum capacitor, and it was back on the air. And I said to myself, my goodness, you guys did a good job. The engineer who did that, I would give him a bonus right at the incident time. They no longer have that ability. The place has been decimated. The bean counters have gotten in there. New research and development doesn't take place. A lot of the engineers have been discouraged. They've gone somewhere else. Modern-day equipment, service manual and the owner's manual and the operating manual have been outsourced. They're not written as well, and the power supplies are not that obvious. Like I said to myself, I'm going to keep using older equipment when it has that kind of built-in real good design and maintainability. Mel, I wonder if you've got anything like that. K2KEY, K2LAW.
W82ITV, what do you suggest?
ITV recognized, but Mel first, go ahead.
Hey, sir, so this is K2KEY. Yeah, well, of course, the power supply on a computer is very easy to test because basically I think all you've got coming out, yes, you got a lot of wires coming out of there, a couple of plugs with lots of wires put there. From what I explained about building, you know, using a computer as a power supply to run your rig, you can tear it down and it becomes actually coming out with two supplies, a 5-volt supply and a 12-volt supply, basically. So you take the two plugs, so with all those wiring there, you'll see usually one is a black wire, or some of them have a belt, you know, this flex belt. But most of, I think, the wires that come off the power supply are regular, like number 22 wire or whatever. And usually I don't think they use flex belts directly off the power supply, at least not on the old one. So you'll find that you've got either, you know, you should have 12 volts or 5 volts, both coming out of that power supply. It's very easy to check. So I would say definitely that's the place to start. And then I'll tell Rich where to find the picture tube. I see it in the book here. So, okay, first let's take care of this gentleman with this computer problem. I wonder if he checked the power supply first, over.
Yeah, W-H-O-I-Q-D said he had a suggestion. Mr. I-Q-D, please start up your name and then please make your suggestion. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, this is W-A-2-I-G-D. That's Italy Golf Delta. And one of the things that you mentioned, so I can afford to reiterate it, when I had someone call me for some kind of a repair, like computer not starting up, it's always usually it's the simplest thing. And this particular case, everything appeared to be plugged into the surge protector, but the gentleman didn't see any light on the surge protector. And what had happened was that the plug that went into the wall had come loose. Either somebody bumped it or whatever. It wasn't the simplest little thing, which I always hope for, of course. The other thing, let me drop it for 1 second. Okay. The other thing is, you know, to check the power supply, they remember purchasing a nice, simple power supply checker. Now that, I think it was CompUSA. And just plug it into that and check everything out for you. But always go for that simplest thing. Sometimes some power supplies have to switch on the back as well. And if accidentally that was shut off, the computer would not come on. By the way, is my audio back again? I made a couple of modifications. Back to you, Nick, W-A-2-I-G-D.
Hey, Charles, that audio sounds good. Rick sounds good. Audio sounds good. You got it made. Anyone else want to make a suggestion to Joe before we pass it back to Joe? Give me your call letters and your name right now.
Yeah, how are you?
Rich recognized. Anyone else? You got it, Rich.
Okay, the suggestion just now, the cord may roll out, hook from the floor, thing first. But if you check the surge suppressor and flushing the back to make sure it didn't get flipped, he wants to check the power supply. A checker would be good, but, you know, you must use a business, I don't know how many times he's going to use it. What you may want to do, Dick, I know I haven't put a computer together in a number of years, but we used to have these mom and pop, we call them, shops, usually run by agents, and they're wonderful, bench checkers, the prices are excellent. We had a number of them here in Whitestone, Chinese, Korean arms, mom and pop computer stores. There's probably still a few around. The power supply in that thing runs broke very easily. From a practical standpoint, I think you can walk into one of those mom and pop stores with the power supply and say, look, I think this is bad. Would you please put it on a machine, get it stand, I'll buy another one. I found these places to be very, very honest. And if it stands, I'll sell them another one at a good price. Thank you, man. Until later.
Thank you, Rich. Rather good suggestion. So, Joe, I hope we've given you a little bit of guidance here. KC2QIW, K2LIW in the Tech Man.
Yeah, Roger. KC2QIW. Yeah, sorry to say that I have no test equipment, and next time I go to my next meeting at the Yonkers Indian Radio Club, I'll bring the tower. I'll bring the tower with me, and those guys would be more than happy to help me with this tower. But yeah, check the switch in the back. Says 115 volts. I checked that. I used the cord and I plugged it in a different outlet, and I checked that, and it still won't fire up. But yeah, thank you for the help and everything, and I'll just pass it over to the other station.
Now, one other thing you should do, Joe, you're going to be using electronics, whether it be computers, ham radio, whatever, for the rest of your life. Therefore, a certain amount of instrumentation should be in your shop, in your travel bag, whatever. If you walk into Radio Shack and you look at the bubble packs on the wall, they have a volt-ohm milliamp meter for about $10, as I remember. $9 and change. I think I've even seen one for $6. And a digital voltmeter, you may be able to get one of those for $30. So a voltmeter is the most basic thing you want to have. And they've got a bunch of different scales, a nice test probe, all comes with it. As I said, it's in a bubble pack at Radio Shack. You can't go wrong. If you don't already own one of those, you should. And with that, you can say, yep, Con Ed is giving me 121 volts today, and I'm happy. And it gave me 109 volts on a hot day yesterday when everyone's cranking out their air conditioners. Now I know why my lights were dim. It's nice to have, you know, basic instrumentation where you can measure the voltage coming out of the wall socket. You can measure the voltage flowing through the on-off switch of your tower computer. You can measure the voltages coming out of the power supply. The next thing beyond that, of course, is an oscilloscope. And the used market oscilloscopes can be had occasionally at a nice price. Brand new, they're a reasonably big investment. I don't think you can get a usable oscilloscope brand new for anything less than $400 or $500. But maybe you guys are going to correct me on that one. But on the flea market, occasionally you'll get a kind of an old clunker. And an old clunker is a lot better than none at all. And I've occasionally seen them for, you know, $30, a workable oscilloscope. Now, along those lines, when we pass it back to Mel, he's going to tell you he found your cathode ray tube replacement for your Kenwood monitor scope. However, in the meantime, you're a pretty well-equipped guy. You've got an oscilloscope. You properly connect the probes of your horizontal and vertical circuit of your oscilloscope, and some modern-day oscilloscopes also have a Z-axis modulation where you can even get a blanking of the retrace. You connect an oscilloscope correctly to your monitor scope circuitry, and you can display that beautiful picture on your oscilloscope, and you'll get a slightly brighter, slightly larger picture. And that's a good standby. But Mel's found the CRT for you. K2KEY, K2LIW in the Tech Man.
The time is 10:34 p.m. Welcome to W2BL. Repeater, good evening.
No, this is K2KEY. You took all the words out of my mouth, Dick. I was going to just say to that gentleman before that you go to Radio Shack. Exactly. You buy one of those meters, or you can get them. They advertise a number of places, and you know, in QST advertise, they got these meters that they sell also very cheap, and a good thing to have around the shack with. You're always going to use it. As far as scope goes, yeah, that's what I have. I have my own station monitor system. And what I use is when I built the station monitor system, I said, gee, I got a nice 50 meg scope, literally with brand new 50 meg scope, that a dual channel scope and attaching, beautiful instrument. And I said, hey, I got everything here. And I made the peripherals. I got one gadget hooked onto it that's on the receiver, Rich has there, so that we can look at the pan of the approximately 25 kilohertz or so either side of the signal that he's listening to. I have also for it indicates modulation. On the other channel, I have modulation. I have a display also that tells me SWR. I have a display that tells me frequency. I have all that, and I use that scope as the station monitor. Now, recently, a friend of mine bought a new Yaesu rig, and they got a thing called the DMU, Data Management Unit, that they sell, that you plug in now to the back of this new transceiver, just a monitor, a regular FPGA monitor, and it reads out everything on a FPGA monitor. So it's an elegant way to go. I was thinking already of how to utilize an FPGA monitor instead of the screen on the scope. In other words, why not use that? I haven't worked out really how to really do it, but I'm thinking in those directions. Now, as far as Rich goes with the CRT, Rich goes to Radio Day. Did you ever hear of that company, Rich, over?
I heard you mention it. It's an RADIO-DAC.
Gotcha. I'm looking. They got the 3BP1. That's the picture tube. I couldn't think of a number. That was used in a number of the 3-inch scopes that Heathkit had on the market, the 3BP1. They cost new for $38, Rich. It'll basically maybe have to redo the somewhat because you're, you know, dealing with a foreign tube right now, so you both have to rewire the base. But for $38, Rich, you're going to have a brand new CRT in there if you want to pursue it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to go on their website and take a look. I'm a stickler on keeping track of the original, if possible, because, you know, this still builds metrics, we'll practice the metrics, if possible. I'm probably beating it dead on, but I know it's impossible to find it. I have the number schematic, I have to pull it out, but it's basically unavailable to. If I can find somebody who redoes them, you know, we build them, and that's getting to the slip shot also.
Possible. They do not have P1 phosphorus. That's the problem. None of these places ever had P1 phosphorus. That's it. P4 is the only thing that they know from. Unless they rebuilt color tubes of the old color tubes with a P22. But you asked them for P1 phosphorus, and you're wasting your strength of trying to convince them that they can do it. It's just not possible. It's a dead end, like I say. And I was thinking of a funny story about a plug out of the wall situation, which I once had a terrible situation here where I had to drive 100 miles to put a plug in when I was working on a miserable night. I had to drive within 10 miles of the edge of the island one night, and at 7 o'clock I got beat to emergency that the monitor was out, and I went out there, drove at 7 o'clock in a miserable night with sleeting and everything like that to almost out to the edge of the island of Montauk, and found that what was on the monitor, somebody. And I have BNC connectors. You know, I never thought with BNC, you snap them on, they don't come off, but somebody touched it and didn't know how to snap it on. You know, they turned it, and they just pushed it in, and it fell out. So I'll never forget that situation. Let's talk about plugs. All right, I think enough of this jazz that you fixed that. So anyhow, shall we go on, try one more thing?
Yeah, let me go back to Rich's question now. I just suddenly realized that some of the monitor scopes sweep slowly across the frequency region of the beginning of the IF strip, and by a long delay phosphor eliminate much of the flicker. The one thing real wrong with many of these substitute CRTs for using his oscilloscope is that it doesn't have variable persistence. Yes, there is a kind of oscilloscope used on the Hewlett-Packard 8555 series of spectrum analyzers where the basic display device has a variable persistence control, a rather elaborate cathode ray tube where it stores the signal on the screen, and you can make the storage on the screen last from an hour down to a millisecond continuously, anything in between. It will repaint itself, so to speak, and erase the signal on the screen. It's got a flood gun. It's got a storage screen and a flood gun. The flood gun will slowly wipe out the picture, and you can set the amount of illumination of the flood gun, and therefore make the persistence of the thing you painted on the screen last either forever or as brief as you like. Have you ever used one of those? They're a little bit elaborate to set up, but there are times when they're very handy. Back to you, Mel.
Oh, when I tell you a story about that, that was, yep, the old packet, they have that called the read-write system that was developed. I don't remember what it was really, the original development was for it, but I once borrowed one of those scopes. And that thing, was a small fortune. And what did I borrow it for? Try it on slow scan. And it was great because once I painted the picture on the screen, I could lock it on there rather than have it, the phosphorus. I was using, of course, all the original flow scan experiments that I did with Top Floor McDonald's. We were using T7 phosphorus. So this thing here was a thing that you could read, and I could say it would stay on that CRT indefinitely until you actually discharged it. It was called a read-write CRT, Dick, over.
You got it. Now, setting the controls, the intensity control, the read control, the write control, the system, setting all the controls just right is a bit of an art form. It does take a learning curve. And by the way, this spectrum analyzer that I borrowed from my buddy has that function built in. And when you go down to the narrowest scan, the 10 hertz resolution bandwidth filter, and you sweep very slowly across the screen, that variable persistence function is very handy. I'll bet you, just like me, discovered that it's difficult to set, but when you get it right, it can do things you can't do any other way. The modern digital display devices can't come close to that particular function. They've got something almost as good. They've got a display matrix where you slowly update what's in the display matrix. The display matrix is being painted onto the screen 30 times per second, but you're updating it once every 30 seconds, so to speak. And so it all comes out right. But and if somebody missets those controls, yeah, can you burn a hole in that very expensive cathode tube? I guess the more modern ones have got a protect circuit, but the earlier ones missed that, you could do damage to it. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, Dick, I got the number on this tube, out of the Kenwood manual. It's a 75 AR-B31.
Yeah, that's right. It's a T31, right? Blue screen.
Yep, B is in blue, B31. 75 AR-B31. And apparently it's unavailable. I checked everywhere, including places that deal in hard to get, no longer available CRTs. Nobody has.
And on a quick break there, Mel, you borrowed for your slow scan TV experiment, I think it was a complete oscilloscope. Now, when it comes to the variable persistence display of the mainframe of the Hewlett-Packard early 8555 spectrum analyzers, they had that variable persistence. Did somebody actually make a complete oscilloscope with variable persistence? And I bet that's a fairly expensive and fairly rare animal. Thank you, Mel.
Sure did. This is K2KY. the company that produced it, now let me remember them. I think they were French. If I remember correctly, it was a French company. Because, oh my God, I can't remember the name. You remember a French instrument maker, Dick, that made very high-end instruments? They were very popular for a while. They used to import them in. I don't think you see them anymore. Do you have any idea who I'm talking about, Dick? Over.
Sure do. Nick Lett. Was it Nick Lett?
That's the cigar tonight. Nick Lett. That's right. They're the ones that made it. Because the CRT that was used in the Hewlett packets and all those read and write tubes, at that time, you know, was French made. It was a French company that was making those tubes, Dick, over.
Yeah, both Nick Lett and C.F. Thompson made some really exotic things. C.F. Thompson made some extremely great traveling wave tube, microwave amplifiers, high power, medium power, high gain, whatever. They also made, I think they were the first company I know of that made a so-called ubiquitous spectrum analyzer. This was a spectrum analyzer which probably had variable persistence in place, but it also had a full, fast Fourier transform function built in so that you give it an exotic waveform and it would display that waveform on the screen as a spectrum analyzer with 1 hertz or 0.1 hertz of resolution. Hewlett-Packard eventually came out with an equivalent called the Dynamic Signal Analyzer, but I think Nick Lett did it first. I think Nick Lett did that way back in the early 60s. Back to you, Mel.
Dick, can you put me into rotation WCEO with me a chance? I don't want to interrupt this.
Okay. Mel's about to go to the very next item in the mailbag. While he's selecting one, why don't you give us a little bit of a lecture as to what you've been doing, maybe, WHCDL, the technical maven, KQRIW.
Okay, very good. By the way, if anyone is interested, the Giants won, and they're in a Super Bowl. So if anybody can see the game, it came down to a field goal, which made the difference between winning and losing. 23-3. Actually, no. 23-20. A 3-point difference. Okay. I don't want to interrupt too much, and I got to go at 11 o'clock anyway. But I'll make this quick. First of all, we're working on solving some of the issues with IRLP and why the timeout timer didn't want to work properly tonight. That's a different situation altogether. Oh, stand by 1 second. Let me fix that problem. WD2HWW, a comment for Andy, please. Okay, I just fixed the problem. Go ahead, what's your comment? Keep changing the timeout time. I've been noticing it. On IRLP, if you continue to talk, it's going to time out, and that's the day jammer. It's preventing you from walking up other zones. That's what it is. If I'm all in, you have a COS lockup. It's more than 2.5 or whatever he said before. You can't stop that.
Okay. Yeah, we know. That's very good. By the way, you're just barely getting into the repeater. I can just hear you above the noise level. But thanks. We're working on to solve that problem.
Yeah, I don't think you can solve it because I've had that problem too. If you got somebody long-winded, that COS detect is going to be there to prevent you from locking up other systems of the reflector.
Right. Yep. That's exactly right.
I've been doing IRLP for a long time. In fact, you have to go in there, and if you do, you know, I know what you're trying to do. You know, you want to run the test set. The only thing you can probably do is to tell everybody to let go after so many sessions because you got to lock up. That software is preventing you from tying up and timing out everybody else. Because remember, there's a timer on both ends. There's a timer at the other guy's end for preventing his box from timing up his transmitter.
All right, so anyway, let me just get to the quick question, Dick, and actually not a question, just some information. I discovered something, and I want to find out if this is real or if it's fake. Dick, can I proceed?
You sure can. We're all ears.
Okay. Given that we had an HRU event last week where we demonstrated transmitter hunting, we we followed it up today with a transmitter hunt in the cold weather at Eisenhower Park. We posted this on our website, the Lithrock website. Now, we had a few guys that came out and we had a good time. However, here's the interesting part. I teamed up with a guy who normally doesn't go out, and he brought with him a loop antenna, a mirror like this one. This is a 2-meter loop that's built by a company called Arrow Antennas. In fact, I'm on their website now. And along with the 2-meter loop, they offer a offset attenuator, which is simply a little oscillator which offsets the existing frequency by 4 megs, and then you can adjust the bias on a diode which varies the injection of the oscillator and thereby causing the signal to be attenuated 4 megacycles away, which works okay. Not the greatest, but it does work. However, just to let you know, I was with the guy and in the park, and it was a foot hunt. It was all on foot this morning. And he gets out with a loop antenna, and he's searching for the transmitter. I'm about to get out of my car, and I noticed that he's aimlessly searching around, sort of like not knowing in what direction to go. So I approach him, and I said, "Gary, are you having trouble with this loop antenna?" And he says, "Here, I can't seem to get a good reading." So I take a look and I see that if I take it from him and I swing the loop around, and the nose should be through the loop, as normal loops give. And I see that the loop is not doing anything. I'm not getting a null. I'm not getting a peak. I am getting a fairly strong signal. I use the attenuator to knock the signal down. I rotate the loop antenna 360 degrees, and there's no change. I'm saying, that's kind of strange. This is something that he just bought, and they have it on their website, and I'm saying, okay, let me borrow it and take it home. I want to see, just out of curiosity, where it's resident, why it's not working, and what's wrong with it. Let me just let it drop a second. I'm going to go back to this radio here, because this one's giving me a little bit of trouble. Anyway, to my surprise, or maybe not so my surprise, I just did this a little while ago, I connected the loop antenna, it's got a BNC connector on it, to my MSK antenna analyzer to see where it's resident on a 2-meter band. And to my surprise, it's not at all. In fact, the SWR is at maximum that the MSK can give me. It is not dipping at all at any frequency from 115 megs all the way up to 170 megs continuously. No resonance whatsoever where it's showing SWR anything decent within the range. I was saying to myself, is there a problem with this loop, or did they make a mistake in designing it? I'm wondering about that. I can give you the dimensions of it. Maybe we can figure this one out. But it looks like that's the reason why it's not going. It is out of residence. What do you think, Dick?
Absolutely. That's what I was about to suggest. When a loop of wire is significantly lower than a half wavelength, in physical length, but resonated, it becomes a omnidirectional antenna in the plane of the loop. If I was laying the plane of the loop parallel to the ground, it would be a horizontally polarized antenna, and it would be omnidirectional. As you start making the loop longer and longer, like approaching halfway physical, it starts developing a more dipole-like pattern. But let's go back to the omni pattern. If I have the loop parallel to the ground, and it's short in physical length, but electrically resonated with a big capacitor at the end, If I now tip the loop up so that the plane of the loop is perpendicular to the ground, it will favor the plane of the loop, and there'll be a null perpendicular to the plane of the loop. So down the hole of the donut, so to speak, left and right, you'll get a null if it is resonant. But if that piece of wire is just a simple capacitive probe in space going into the center conductor of a receiver, and that curved piece of wire that you think is a loop is not itself resonant, then it really is an exotic-shaped monopole that is essentially omnidirectional. So the magic of real effective capture area and the magic of an antenna pattern requires resonance. And it's all based on the fact that radiation is hard. You send a signal down the transmission line, you assume that because the transmission line is 70 ohms and the antenna is 70 ohms, the signal is going to slow down the transmission line once, hop under the antenna, which is 70 ohms, and simply jump into space. Never, never does that happen, with the rare exception of a beverage or a rhombic, which is a zillion wavelength long. With that exception, all antennas, the signal has to bounce back and forth 30 times before it's finding it's radiated in space. Those 30 bounces is where the pattern comes from. The 30 bounces is where the effective capture area comes from. The 30 bounces is where the radiation efficiency comes from. If you don't resonate it, you ain't going to transmit power. You ain't going to transmit power with a pattern, and you ain't going to have much of an effective capture area. You got to resonate. The A2CDL, KQLIW.
Okay, that's my theory exactly. Well, the question now is there a problem with this? Is this defective, or did the manufacturer made a mistake? Because it's a quarter-inch piece of tubing. In this case, it's not copper. It could be, it's aluminum, it looks like, very light, aluminum tubing. And it goes into a little BMC connector in the bottom. And on the top, it's broken. It's not complete. And it looks like there's a piece of heat shrink tubing over it on the top part, which forms a capacitor. It looks like where the tubing itself is broken. But the inner, I don't know what's inside of it regarding the size of the wire, because this should resemble a piece of coax cable. I used to make loops like this. The semiconductor of it should be continuous. But, again, I'm going to have to look to see where it is resonating, because it's out of the range on VHF. Unfortunately, my MFJ antenna analyzer, which does cover the UHF portion, is not working. That's, I got to fix that. So I'm going to have to look at that, find another way of seeing where this is resonating. It could be that it's just effective. And this is like the first time, or maybe second time you used it since you bought it. And by the way, the price is about $60 for this loop antenna. Which I think is a little bit pricey since it's just a piece of aluminum that could be made. But it's not resonant at all. So I just wanted to mention that. I'm not familiar with the company Arrow Antennas, and they make some different beam EIE antennas and the name poles and things, which are used for transmitter hunting and some base station antennas, but not too familiar with the company itself. Just thought I'd mention that, Dick. That's you.
K2KYQ.
K2KYQ recognized. Get to you in a second. There's no way that the antenna could not resonate. I don't care if they made the loop of aluminum too big, too small, left-handed, right-handed, too big in diameter, too small in diameter. It doesn't matter. There's got to be a way to force it to resonate. The usual way of feeding a thing like that is that the BNC connector is a coax cable going down the center of the loop, and the center conductor bridges the gap across the top, which has got the heat shrink tubing on it, and maybe that center conductor has been broken at that point. Some portion of that antenna is grounded, some portion of that antenna has got a feed point, some portion of it has got a resonator. There's got to be a way to force it to resonate. So I think it's a broken connection. They couldn't possibly have designed it that badly, if you know what I mean. There's a broken connection somewhere underneath the E-shrink tubing, underneath the BNC connector. Even if the loop is the wrong diameter, there's got to be a way to resonate it. Once it's resonating, you're going to get all kinds of magic. KT2KYQ, start off with your name, sir, and your question or comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
It's K2KYQ, and I just looked at the website, and there's a big warning right above where they give you all the pricing. This is not to be used for transmission. You know, you're not using the transmission purpose until you make damage or equipment. And it gives the range from like 1 megahertz on up to 300, and another one is supposed to buy 500 megahertz. So it's really not meant for transmitting. It looks like it's just a loop. Direction finding group, and I don't know whether those things designed to be resonated.
Mel recognized. Part of what's going on here, Andy, is that the bunny that you were hunting was in the parking lot with you, and you were getting a potent signal. So that antenna could have been 20 dB down from normal performance, and you still would have heard something. Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, I saw one like that. I don't know if it's the same one, Arrow. I think maybe I'm wrong, but I can almost swear it was that. What they do is they tune the loop stick with a vary cap. So if he put RF, like let's say he was using his handy talkie as the receiving for the find the hidden transmitter, if by mistake he pushed the button on a mic, he will kill that. It has, like I say, a vary cap in it. That's how it's resonated, Nick, over.
Yeah, Andy, do you think anybody ever transmitted through that antenna by mistake? It may have either an active preamplifier or a varactor diode. In either case, if it's not made to be transmitted and you transmit it through it, it may have a brand new schematic diagram now, if you know what I mean. So maybe CDL, T2RIW.
Yeah, that's
just,
the feed is back. That's a possibility, although I did not transmit into it, but it's possible that it has been in the past, and maybe that's the problem. I'm not going to take it apart because it's not mine, but at least I know it is not resident on the frequency that I want it to be. Sure, it's resident somewhere, and I'm going to have to find where it is, but not the frequency that we were transmitting on, for sure, anywhere near it. So that's probably what happened, because like you say, I don't think they would design something that just wouldn't work. And it's very easy to take apart, so it's just that's a matter of just looking and seeing what, if anything looks charred or damaged due to an RF condition, that's a possibility. Okay. Very good, Mel, on letting me know about the vary cap that could be in there. I'll have to look and see. I'll give you a follow-up on it. First, I want to get permission to open the thing up and see if I can find what the problem is. Back to you.
Quick question, Andy. Are there any tuning controls on this assembly? Go ahead.
No.
So you're telling me that this is a 2-meter antenna, or at least it's rated as a 2-meter antenna, and you're supposed to connect it to a receiver when you're doing direction finding. There's no gain control, there's no tuning control, there's no on-off control. You're telling me it's just a black box with a BNC connector?
Radio's acting up here. No, it's not a black box. We're talking about the loop antenna itself. It's just a little loop antenna with a BNC connector on it, and the way I described it, a piece of quarter-inch aluminum tubing in the shape of sort of a square, more than round. And it's a loop, and that's it. That's all it is. No adjustments, no nothing.
What are the dimensions of that loop?
6 inches across, horizontally, and vertically about 5 inches across, from end to end.
Okay. And BNC input connector and a heat shrink tubing at the top that's covering up some kind of a junction. Is that true?
That's right, exactly.
I'll bet you inside of that junction something is bad. If you grab the two sides to the left and to the right of the heat shrink tubing and move it a little bit out and in, or left and right, or up and down, Does it move in a way that you think is improper?
Nope, nice and tight. The heat shrink tubing.